And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be looking at one of the most important and influential dancers and choreographers of the 20th century, but looking at her life and career through a very interesting lens. The book at hand is titled Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. Many of you, I'm sure, know the name of Martha Graham, perhaps primarily because of Aaron Copland's masterpiece, Appalachian Spring, which bears the subtitle, the affectionate subtitle, Ballet for Martha. And the Martha in that subtitle is Martha Graham, who conceived of the work's very first performance as a ballet. What is not known to most of us, certainly wasn't known to me until I read this fascinating book, is that Martha Graham, for many years, did her work under the auspices of the U.S. State Department. That not all of her work, but much of her work under the auspices of the U.S. State Department. And the idea being that the dance of Martha Graham, that is, the modern dance of Martha Graham, was thought to be a very powerful force on behalf of American interests around the world. That it would be a powerful statement of who America was, of what America stood for, and in particular of what American freedom could offer the world. And this artistic expression, which of course transcended spoken language, was thought to be an especially effective force, and some might even say a weapon for good. And this is all explored in this fascinating book by its author, Victoria Phillips, who is a scholar of Cold War history and has written extensively on various aspects of it. She is also someone who has been a dancer and has quite an extensive background in that. So this equips her perfectly to write this particular book published by Oxford University Press, again titled Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. Victoria Phillips, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Before we go any further, let's make sure our listeners understand what I was just talking about, that is sort of the dual nature of your expertise when it comes to this particular story and in the writing of this book. Let's first begin with your interest in the Cold War and the kind of study that you have done about that over the years.
Thank you so much. It's interesting that you begin or that you spoke about dance as a weapon and the weaponizing of dance. My immediate scholarly interest in the dance was the way that it was used politically during the early years of its formation. And indeed, there was a phrase called dance as a weapon that was used by these early choreographers. It came from the phrase art as a weapon. Of course, the various arts were used as political weapons initially, interestingly, by the Soviet Union to infiltrate the United States. So of course, what happened was the United States very cleverly took that, swapped it around, and made dance into a weapon. However, during the Cold War, because ballet wasn't something that was particularly American, as a matter of fact, it had its origins in the European and then the Russian, it was an apples to oranges fight with the modern dance because the Soviets had no modern dance. So when they showed up with their beautiful ballerinas and tulle and pointe shoes, we could show up with our powerful women freed, with freed bodies and bare feet, but show equally lovely and powerful technique with the length of the legs and the arches of the feet. However, we were telling stories of real people, in a sense, human beings, angst, terror, joy. There was a wonderful use of dance as a weapon, particularly in the Cold War, when the Soviets had nothing to retaliate with when we brought modernism. My initial interest in this subject came from my studying with Martha Graham. I was at the school in the 1970s, late 1970s, taking the company class, learning the repertory. And indeed, at one point, the entire company disappeared. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And they came back. Indeed, they had gone to the Middle East on the Jimmy Carter Goodwill Tour to Egypt, Oman, and Israel as a part of the peace accord agreements. I never knew this, particularly because Martha Graham always insisted my work is not political. And that is where I became extremely interested, because I had understood from the woman herself, my art is not political, then to find her performing in the White House or on tour for every single American president, Roosevelt through Bush, made her, to me, certainly political, something to be explored as political. So as she made her works that spoke to what she believed and what I believe is the core of humanity, the terror, the angst, the grief in some of the works such as Lamentation, her first work of 1930, this deep belief in the United States with Appalachian Spring, which certainly reads as a bit dated these days with the tale of the frontier and the bride and the husbandman. Indeed, she began to understand these characters not as just a bride, but of a woman full of hope, not as a husband, but as an astronaut. So these tropes, in a sense, became archetypes under her watch. And then they became extremely politically expedient, shall we say, for the United States during the Cold War.
I'm just curious, I hadn't thought I would ask you this, but could you just take a moment to describe what she was like personally? I mean, as someone who actually studied with this legendary woman, what was she like to interact with, and what was she like as a teacher?
She was absolutely, it was terrifying being in the room with her, and it was enthralling. We used to say that when you put your hand on the doorknob, you could tell whether she was in the school or not because it vibrated. I always knew that she was in the school because they would place flowers on the piano, and I always sat under the, or not, right next to the piano. That was my spot, a front row off to the left by the piano. She dominated the room. The woman had an incredible charisma, which I think it also forms a part of the story in the book. She would not have been sent by every president had she not had the charisma of an ambassador. She was just as good, if not better, in embassy parties and in lecture demonstrations as she was on stage playing these characters. So that was her persona. She had an eagle eye. She felt that all she needed to do was have you walk across the room and she could tell all about you, which I do believe she could in some way, shape, or form. I had the wonderful experience of having my father sit and watch me take class with her. And he marveled at the Americanness of this woman who preached hard work, freedom, dedication to a cause. The cause in her case was good art, truth.
You already mentioned that she did not like to think of herself as a political person. So this was not what she was directly about. But you also, in the book, mentioned the fact that she took issue with being called a feminist. So she did not want to be known as a political person of any kind, and did not want to be known as a feminist. Can you explain what her issue was with being called a feminist, or being, in a sense, categorized with the feminist movement?
One of the things that I found fascinating about writing this book was, of course, because of my personal experience of seeing the company disappear in an apolitical tour on behalf of Jimmy Carter and the Camp David Accords, one of the things that fascinated me as I delved further into her story was her claim that she was not a feminist. And here she is, a woman on tour in the, from, you know, the 1920s building a company, but then on six-week tours that covered every span of the globe with the exception of Africa, running a company, making sure everyone behaved, choreographing, starring in the works, going to embassy parties, managing the finances. I mean, we don't think about this a lot. The logistics, raising money, making sure the sets arrived. I mean, there's, you know, she was the CEO, the CFO, the chief fundraiser, and the circus ringleader, in a sense. There was a lot for this woman to do. So what people have done is said, well, she behaves like a feminist, so she must be a feminist, which I think is a bit retroactive, and doesn't go to the fact that she wanted to be apolitical for a very particular reason, and feminism was to her a part of a movement, a political movement. And she wanted to be removed from the politics, because how else could she perform for every president, from Nixon to Roosevelt, from Ford to Johnson. Yes, so Democratic, Republican, belief in New Deals, belief in free market economies. I mean, she and Reagan were like schoolgirl and schoolboy giggling at parties. But she was just as comfortable with Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt, who had very different political views. So in order for her to build this charisma, she needed to be apolitical. Although she behaved in a certainly political way. She also said, I'm not a modernist. And she said, I'm not a missionary. And the book proves that she was actually all four, in a sense.
Hmm. It might also be helpful for our listeners not acquainted with the world of dance. And I certainly am no dance aficionado myself, but certainly I have at least a rough sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about the modern dance as embodied by Martha Graham. And I think you've already pretty much touched on this nicely in drawing a bit of a contrast between, for instance, the kind of dance that Martha Graham was about, and for instance, the kind of dance that, for instance, the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War would be sharing with the world. But aside from her dance being not that, what else would you say that would help someone not acquainted with her style to understand what the modern dance of Martha Graham was all about?
The way I like to think about it is to appreciate the classical ballet and Martha Graham, I like people to think about the ballet Giselle or Swan Lake. When you have these, but more Giselle, you have a woman who goes mad at the end of the first act because of her love for a man that's unrequited. And in her case, it's a class issue and it's a noble, but the fact is that the woman is in terrible, desperate pain and goes mad. And I contrast that, the point shoes and the costuming and the beautiful hair and the high legs and the precise vocabulary steeped in monarchies from the French, with Graham's Lamentation of 1930, in which she speaks to human grief, the lament of loss. And in that, she has bare feet, twisted limbs. She dances inside a tube. All you see is her face and the angled bodies as she sits on a bench, her mangled hands, mangled feet. And it expresses this exact same grief as Giselle, but in human terms, so that she strips away the who, we don't know who the person is, the where, we don't know where she is, the when, we don't know the situation, it's not the 17th century, it's not the 12th century, it's not the 21st century. It is of the moment, it is of the time, it is the experience of the what, of the grief. And that is the ideal of modernism, is to get to strip a movement to its essence to convey an essential human bond that we would all share. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Victoria Phillips, and we're talking about her brand new book, Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. The book explores a very important facet of the career of Martha Graham, one of the most important and influential dancers and choreographers of the 20th century. The work that she did, in a sense, as I was going to say, an unofficial diplomat of the United States. I mean, that in some ways the word unofficial is not quite right, because her work in this way was very much done in cooperation with the U.S. State Department and at their behest. And yet she wasn't probably labeled overtly as a diplomat, as a diplomat. But in fact, that was what was going on, particularly at the height of the Cold War. And Victoria Phillips's book explores all of this in very intriguing fashion. Before we dig into some specifics in your fascinating book, I want you to say a word about some of the remarkable information that was available to you that would not have been available even a few years ago. You make specific mention of a couple of things, including the Martha Graham archives at the Library of Congress, which evidently were available to you in a way that perhaps they had not been available before. Tell our listeners about what was most valuable to you in researching this story.
For me, what was most valuable, Greg, was the chase and the sense of getting a hint from one thing and going to the next. One of the things in the Martha Graham archives was a letter from Eleanor Dulles to Martha Graham thanking her for her work in Berlin. And I thought, 1957, I thought, well, that's very interesting. Who is Eleanor Dulles? She seems to have the last name as the Secretary of State and the head of this director of the CIA. I didn't know that Martha Graham went to Berlin. And that led to a long chase, which took me to Washington, to the State Department archives, where I could find very little. And indeed, the documents ended up being in Berlin, which even surprised the State Department archivist, that they were not housed. The U.S. documents were in the German federal repository. So it was little hints like that. Another example of that would be the wonderful new opening or online opening of the Central Intelligence Agency documents. And so you can go in, anyone can go in and stick a name in and get some results. I found when I put Martha Graham in, I found numerous reports in Congress and the like. But what was really interesting was a report on her landing in Indonesia in 1955-56 and her landing pattern and the name of her plane. All of a sudden I thought, well, that's very interesting. She traveled with two planes always, one for sets and costumes, one for the dancers. They oftentimes traveled with other people, an integrated tennis team in the 1950s, which is very interesting because our tennis teams were not integrated in the United States. And realized that, well, Eisenhower had this tendency to put cameras on the bottom of planes. And then that led me to the Bandung Conference, which was a very important international event that the Dulles brothers were very upset by. And there she lands in Indonesia within, you know, within 6 months of this very political conference with Appalachian Spring and the great story of the American frontier. It was following the clues like a detective, because if a woman says my work is not political, it's going to be a little difficult to find her political work. Mm-hmm.
I appreciated one moment in the introduction to the book when you help us kind of reevaluate the term propaganda. And of course, a big part of what we're talking about in terms of this work that Martha Graham did on some of these tours sponsored by the U.S. State Department is that we're talking about propaganda, in a sense, to make the United States look good, particularly in certain countries that were thought to be kind of on the edge of tilting one way or another, but perhaps tilting away from us and towards the world of communism. And so Martha Graham was thought to be a figure whose dance work could be very effective pro-USA propaganda. You say in the introduction, propaganda has become a sullied term, and I think you're absolutely right. You go on to kind of talk about the way in which propaganda was thought of, especially back in this era, and in particular, something really fascinating I'd never heard about, that is different levels of propaganda, black, white, and gray. Would you explain that hierarchy of propaganda, black, white, and gray, and then where Martha Stewart's work fits within that hierarchy?
So, black propaganda would be something that would be absolutely covert, manipulating elections, coups, and the like. White propaganda would be something that would be fairly easily definable. Gray propaganda is something where there would be some covert funding for something that would appear to be a spontaneous eruption, shall we say. One of the things I found most fascinating in that was CIA funding for the arts. And I think that's where you get into a gray category. So the CIA would fund various foundations that would then fund artists that would then work on behalf of the State Department. I would think of kind of the gray as kind of the layered. And there is no doubt that Martha Graham received some of that kind of funding, as did others. Where I find propaganda aspects of Graham so interesting. Of course, there's Singapore, where she arrives in 1955. We arrive with Appalachian Spring. We have just, it's the tale of how the United States triumphed over the British, just as the Singaporeans are looking to triumph over the British. We brought freedom and democracy. Well, look what happened to us. We have a great frontier. So that's, kind of fairly pure and straightforward. However, and that's a dance with a clear message, a clear pro-American frontierism message. What becomes very interesting to me is when Martha Graham just did the right thing and it became good propaganda. And where I really look at that is in her belief in human beings. So in the interwar period, when many U.S. choreographers, dance companies would not hire Jewish dancers, Martha Graham hired them in the 1920s and 30s. In the 1940s, when the United States put Japanese in internment camps, Martha Graham hired a Japanese dancer out of an internment camp and toured with her during the war. In 1951, when racism was extreme in the United States, Martha Graham hired two African-American dancers, Matt Tierney and Mary Hinkson, and stopped touring the South, gave up work in order to include those dancers in her company. So she comes to the United States government with what they call the United Nations of Dance, which is perfect propaganda because the Soviets say we're racist, and Martha Graham has a very racially, ethnically, religiously diverse company showing the best of the American melting pot. Now, did Martha Graham do that for the government? Absolutely not. She had been doing it since the 1920s and 30s. Hmm. She made these statements well before there was any hint of a government tour because she believed them. So in their execution, when she had Yuriko, Mary Hinkson herself play Clytemnestra and play the grief and angst of a woman, Pearl Lang, who was Jewish, she was making a statement. When she had Mary Hinkson, who was African-American, and Bertram Ross play the epitome of love, the purity of love on stage, she wasn't doing that to make a statement. She chose the best dancers for the job. Hmm. However, when you put Mary Hinkson and Bertram Ross on stage in Johnson's White House, just as he's fighting for civil rights, and you've got a picture of Mary and Bert being greeted by Lady Bird and Martha I'm in the State Department dining room. Well, that looks a lot like propaganda.
I'm reminded as you're talking about that, about a term that I didn't know too much about, which you also mentioned for the first time in the introduction, and that is the notion of soft power. Explain what that term means and how that is a very good description of the effectiveness of Martha Graham and these many of these dance tours.
Greg, that's an excellent question, and it is among academics a much contested term. However, it is quite useful. Soft power would be compared to hard power. Hard power is the obvious military, guns, battles, hand-to-hand combat. Soft power would be the idea that you want to make an impression, you want to, in a sense, clear the land of your enemies, however, with products, ideas, offerings that would be more, in a sense, seductive. Rather than forcing something on somebody, you are cajoling them, suggesting to them that your way is better. And in this, Martha Graham fit in with a smorgasbord of products. There's another phrase called empire by invitation. In other words, to make yourself irresistible, given the phrase of one of my mentors, Victoria de Grazia, and I think the clearest soft power export might be something like Coca-Cola or blue jeans. Mm. Which some say, marked the end of the Cold War. I don't happen to buy into that, but that is the idea that you have something that you make other people believe that you have something that they want.
Interesting. And it's that something is something that would spring right out of the American experience. I mean, that in other words, it's not an accident that this is something that comes out of America, but it comes out of America because America is what it is and what it stands for.
Right. Yes, Greg. And there's the idea that's stated in documents, which I found quite fascinating, is something called the translation effect. In other words, if somebody sees Martha Graham doing something that they would like to do or something that looks interesting, they will then think, oh, America isn't so bad. I want to be like America. And that was literally called the translation effect. And policies of what was called modernization by the social scientists was actually a term that was borrowed from the artists and the modernist artist. So the idea was that you would use a new technique, a brand new shining technique to make things modern, new, better. Hmm. So as we were promoting modernization in these newly freed countries after World War II, we sent the modern dance. Hmm.
Another term I want to ask you about, and I'm curious to what extent it relates to this notion of soft power, is the concept of trickle-down diplomacy. This term comes up again and again in your book. What's meant by this term? And again, how did Martha Graham's efforts in this regard embody the notion of trickle-down diplomacy?
When I found the term trickle-down diplomacy, I was almost as enthralled as when I found the term the cocktail circuit of diplomacy. And I do think the two go hand in hand. The idea that particularly at the start of the Cold War into the early 60s perhaps, was the idea that if you could convince the leaders that something was true, then it would trickle down to the rest of the population. And it's a bit like cutting taxes for the wealthy. So if you make the wealthy very rich, then everything will trickle down and to the others. So it's I think in a sense borrowed from economics. This turned out not to be as true as the State Department thought. And I think particularly when you started seeing the riots in 1953 in Berlin, which attached themselves to Graham, the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, revolutions in Poland, what you began to see was the youth bubbling up as a force for democracy. And so there was an adjustment that had to be made. If you were at first thinking, oh, I better go to that cocktail party to reform the leaders so that so democracy will trickle down as a great idea to everybody else. Well, all of a sudden, you know, if we look at the pictures of the Berlin Wall falling, we do not see very many elderly leaders pulling down bricks. And that was a trend that was well understood by the United States. And it started well before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it was something that was highly encouraged. So that by the 1970s, rather than sending many different things that would appeal to the elites, the government was much more interested in appealing to the youth, with youth programs, with music, with other products that would be more youth oriented in a sense. So Martha Graham's continued to go out, but not as many high art, shall we say, proscenium theater dance companies went out.
Right. In other words, what was seen as very useful early on, as time goes on, begins to be seen as less and less useful, or maybe regarded as less and less central to our efforts.
Yes, I think central is the key word. It was useful, however, not as useful as it was first deemed at the beginning of the Cold War. I think the other issue is the propaganda issue. At the beginning of the Cold War, the Soviets were saying that we were uncouth, that we were barbaric, that we couldn't lead the world because we were Hollywood bubblegum and hot dogs. And so there was also this idea that we had to convince the world that we were sophisticated, that we had great art, and that we had not only great art, but a freed approach to great art. And that's where symphony orchestras, Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, jazz artists, Martha Graham, Jose Limon, American Ballet Theater, that's where all of these exports come in to prove that we were a sophisticated nation. I think that became less and less important over time.
We're speaking with Victoria Phillips about her book, Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. She explores the work that Martha Graham did, one of the most important influential dancers and choreographers of the 20th century, and in particular, the work that Martha Graham did under the auspices of the U.S. State Department, particularly at the height of the Cold War. Victoria Phillips, what do we know about the origins of this connection between Martha Graham and the U.S. State Department? I mean, can we trace that to a particular figure in the State Department who came up with this idea that Martha Graham would be a potent and effective instrument on behalf of the U.S. government?
If I had to trace it, I would link that first contact to Eleanor Roosevelt. Some of my students had a wonderful phrase. They said Eleanor Roosevelt was the Oprah of the interwar. She had radio, she had syndicated columns. She was quite a powerful figure that supported the new arts and very, very strongly believed in creating a new America with social programs. Eleanor Roosevelt invited Martha Graham to perform at the White House in 1937, and Martha Graham did a solo called Frontier, which was about a woman on the frontier experiencing the vastness of the plains and the like. And then Eleanor Roosevelt wrote about Graham in her column, Graham became known nationally through Roosevelt. So she not only was connected immediately in, with the power brokers of the Roosevelt administration while she performed during a quite small state dinner, she also was introduced to the public as an ambassador for America, well before anybody went on tour. I think Roosevelt set the mechanisms in place for dance as an export. His administration sent ballet to Latin America in 1941 with Nelson Rockefeller and Lincoln Kirstein. And that model is then followed by Truman, picked up by Eisenhower, militarized in a sense, I claim, by Eisenhower, and then Martha Graham becomes the first official State Department tour under Eisenhower in 1955. His Operations Coordination Board had sent Jose Limon in 1954, but the or planned it in 54, but the first official State Department export was Graham to Asia. Interestingly, the domino nations, under Eisenhower. The book opens with a refrain from an opera that was written by the Brubecks and Louis Armstrong. And it says, when they sensed internal mayhem, they sent out Martha Graham. That's what we call cultural exchange. And that really started under Eisenhower with the domino nations to which Graham was sent. Mm.
Your mention of the word cultural reminds me of something that I think you, a term that you share that I think you perhaps have coined called cultural convergences. Explain the significance of this and how this would play out on a typical Martha Graham tour of this period.
So I think cultural convergences is a very, very tricky term. And for those who know the work of Edward Said, questions of Orientalism and cultural appropriation are rivet in this definition and are extremely problematic in today's world. The idea which really began under Roosevelt in 1941 with the good neighbor policy was that we will show you that we are like you and you are like us. We are interested in you and you are interested in us. So when she went to Asia and the Philippines, a Filipino dancer was pictured in much of the publicity, a Graham Filipino dancer. So that was on the very basic, we are like you, we are interested in you, we as America integrate you into our great companies. However, it wasn't just the publicity. Noguchi was the set designer for Appalachian Spring and many others. He was a Japanese-American sculptor and very famous modernist sculptor. And when they went to Asia, the fact that it was a Noguchi set that Martha Graham was dancing in was promoted very heavily. So sometimes in programs, there would be just the picture of the set. The same thing happened when she went to Israel, where she would do the tale of Judith from the Old Testament to proclaim the power of the Israeli of the Israeli women. She did a work called Frescoes, which she took to Egypt, which was the story of Cleopatra. Now, some of these things you kind of think, oh my, this is most inappropriate. And indeed, in today's world, it would be quite inappropriate because we would, in a sense, call it cultural appropriation. So she took things that look Egyptian, almost mock Egyptian, and put them in this work, Frescoes, to represent Clytemnestra. When she went to Greece, she performed the Greek myths. when she went to Poland and some of the very Catholic companies, they were sure to make sure that Joan of Arc was on stage so that people could relate. So these things are difficult in today's world, not to say, I looked at this and I thought, gag me with a spoon, this can't be right. You know, how? But what was so interesting to me was that she was celebrated in Greece, 1962, for rewriting the Greek myths. She was celebrated, according to the press, in Egypt with frescoes and Amman with frescoes for understanding the traditions and making them modern. So while we sitting in the 21st century have great difficulty with this cultural, what we would call cultural appropriation, at the time it worked in many cases.
You write in the prologue, as the consummate ambassador, she adjusted her presentation to meet local needs and sensibilities. So, and this was not an accident. And it probably depends a little on how one chooses to interpret it in terms of how generously to interpret what she was doing and why. One of the things that I appreciate about your book is its honesty when it comes to the occasional stumbles along the way, that not all of these tours by Martha Graham were equally successful. And there was also the specter of the abuse of alcohol that is part of her story. Your book suggests that an artistic setback of sorts that she experienced, I think in the late 1950s, maybe in a tour of Germany, might have been at the root of some of these escalating problems. Tell us how and why alcohol became a player and how Martha Graham was eventually able to shake off its damaging effects on her.
This is a very, very difficult question that I wrestled with a great deal with the book. Having been at the school and knowing the legends of Graham, I knew personally about the alcoholism and its terrible damaging effects on her and on the company. When I was at the school, she had recovered. She drank quite heavily when she returned from Berlin in 1957 because this tour had not been very successful. However, this had been a long-term problem and a growing problem. By 1962, it was clear that she was under the influence to dancers who wrote home about it, saying Martha fell back into the stage, collapsed into the wings, and they continued dancing, not knowing quite what to do until she reappeared. Bertram Ross tells of moving her limbs because she couldn't move them. She was so inebriated. And State Department memos make reference to her, quote, exhaustion. So what I was able to do was pair up the dancers' stories with the State Department stories and understand that exhaustion became a code word for drunk. At first, I found this very problematic and was kind of upset with my main character for behaving this way. And then as I went on and learned more about her relationship with Betty Ford, who was very open about her alcoholism and pill problem and was quite close to Martha Graham, had studied with Martha Graham and worked with Martha Graham in the White House quite extensively, I realized that for Graham to give up alcohol and to, after having been in a coma, an alcohol-induced coma and close to death, close to drinking herself to death in the late 60s, early 70s, that she then was able to put herself back together, put herself back on stage, not as a performer, but as the matriarch of modern dance, and continue on major tours under Ford, everyone Ford through Bush. And so really it's a story of heroism under the influence of the affliction of alcoholism. And I had to go back and completely rewrite the 1960s in that context. The other thing that, of course, we talked about with the cocktail circuit of diplomacy, in some senses, in the early Cold War, before the alcoholism took over her, being able to hold your alcohol quite important socially. Being able to drink a scotch or a few of them and maintain your composure at a cocktail party was part of what made her valuable as an ambassador. in those days. So I think we also have to go back with a bit of Mad Men look at the earlier chapters and understand that at what can become the Achilles heel of somebody's career was at one point a valuable asset.
Fascinating. I want to mention briefly, we unfortunately don't have time to talk about it, but I really appreciate the time that you take right in the middle of the book at that point in Martha Graham's career when her skills as a dancer are deteriorating to the point where she simply must step away from the stage as a dancer, in part, of course, due to this alcoholism problem, but also the inevitability of aging. But we're really, I feel like you do a great job of kind of putting us in her shoes as a dancer who hates to give up the dance as a dancer, but eventually realizes that that time has passed and she must move forward from there solely as a impresario and choreographer, but of course continues to do really, really important work. The book again is titled Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. It includes a plethora of fascinating photographs as well that further enrich the vivid story that is told here. The book is published by Oxford University Press. The author, Victoria Phillips. Victoria Phillips, this is a terrific book. It's a fascinating story and a complicated story that you tell very, very well. And I hope that many people will seek out your book and explore it in even deeper detail than we were able to explore in this conversation. I thank you very much for being part of the Morning Show today. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Greg.